Welcome to the Iron Rod Podcast. This is Chris, joined by Taylor, and this is episode 158 of the Iron Rod Podcast. In fact, happy anniversary. 3 years ago this week that we did our first episode.
Oh, goodness. How time flies. A lot of water under the bridge, but the common thread is the Word of God.
That's what we aim for. We're just going to pick up where we left off last week at the beginning of May. One thing I wanted to comment on, I forgot to mention it last week. Zion's camp, or the camp of Israel, part of the group left on May 1st, and they went a few miles away to New Portage, and then they kind of waited there for the rest of the group to get together. And then it was on May 4th that we had the conference that changed the name of the church to the Church of Latter-day Saints. And then it was on May 6th that Joseph and the rest headed down to New Portage to join up with the others and then start the journey. I just find it fascinating that in the middle of trying to gather everyone up and start heading towards Missouri, they decide to have this conference and take the name of Christ out of the church.
It's very telling. The only way you know this is to put the revelations within the context of the history and look at it chronologically. And we're not used to doing that in the church. We look at things piecemeal and take it completely out of context. And yet, as we go on and understand what happens with the camp of Israel as they move towards Missouri, you can see this shift that is only going to get reinforced over the next couple of episodes, away from being the Church of Christ to being the Church of the Latter-day Saints in its downgraded state.
And another thing I noticed that I, again, should have said last week, don't know why I didn't say it, but it's even more relevant this week. Section 103 has this statement that Joseph Smith is the man to whom I likened the servant about the parable of the vineyard, and that he's going to be the one that goes and redeems Zion. But if you read it really carefully, in verse 30, it doesn't talk about redeeming Zion anymore. It just says, it is my will that my servant Parley P. Pratt and my servant Lyman White should not return to the land of their brethren until they have obtained companies to go up unto the land of Zion by 10s, 20s, 50s, or 100. It's just saying, I don't want those two to go back alone. Have them go back with other men. But it never mentions that they're going to redeem Zion. And in verse 35, he says, and then pray earnestly that peradventure Joseph could go with you. So Joseph's attendance doesn't even seem to be necessary, which if Joseph were truly going to redeem Zion, wouldn't he have to actually be there in person?
One would think, but again, it's a subtle hint at what's going on here.
I say that because as we get into section 105 and Zion's camp, people will say, well, Joseph failed to redeem Zion. It was a failure. The Lord never commanded him to redeem Zion at this time. So the group leaves around May 6th and they start heading over to Missouri. And it takes about a month. It's at the Salt River on June 8th that the two contingents, there's the Kirtland contingent that's kind of heading on the southern route. And then you had Hiram Smith and Lyman White, who had kind of gone north through Michigan. They join up on June 8th and then head the rest of the way into Independence, and they get there around June 20th.
And let me just note that word that the Mormons were coming had spread before they got there, such that on June 21st, the sheriff of Clay County, along with a delegation of men from Clay and Ray counties, met with Joseph and members of the camp, informing them of the great alarm the expedition had caused among Western Missouri residents. Section 105 is given as a result of a council once these two had combined prior to them going into Independence.
Yeah, and actually on the 21st, when that sheriff was talking to them, they actually wrote up a little declaration to try and ease the fears. They wrote, in the first place, it is not our intention to commence hostilities against any man or body of men. It is not our intention to injure any man's person or property, except in defending ourselves. It is our intention to go back upon our lands in Jackson County. We have brought arms for the purpose of self-defense, as it is well known to almost all the people of the state that we have reason to put ourselves in an attitude of defense, considering the abuse that we have suffered in Jackson County. We are anxious for a settlement of the difficulties existing between us upon honorable and constitutional principles. We are willing that 12 disinterested men, 6 chosen by ourselves and 6 by the people of Jackson County, and these men shall say what the possessions of those men are worth who cannot live in the county with us, and they shall have their money in 1 year, and none of our people shall enter that county to reside until the money is paid. The damages which we have sustained in consequence of being driven shall also be left to the above 12, where they may all live in the county if they choose, and we will never molest them if they will let us alone and let us enjoy natural rights. We want to live in peace with all men, and equal rights is all we require. We want to become permanent citizens of the state and bear our proportion in supporting the government thereof, that we may be protected by her laws. If the above proposals are complied with, we are willing to give security on our parts, and shall want the same of the people of Jackson County for the performance of the agreement. We do not wish to settle down in a body except where we can purchase the lands with money, for to take possession by conquest or the shedding of blood is something foreign to our feelings. The shedding of blood we shall not be guilty of until all just and honorable principles among men prove ineffectual to restore peace.
Ooh, that's a little bit of a threat at the end.
It is a little bit of threat at the end, but I'm shocked that I've never been told that Joseph's purpose here was not to redeem Zion and kick out all the non-members and cleanse the land. But this was just, we want to take these people that have been driven off their lands, get them restored back on. If you're not going to let them back on, then you need to compensate them so they can go somewhere else and start all over again. It's a very different goal than what we've been told was the goal, but failed.
Right. But you can also understand why the local populace were probably very suspicious of this declaration, given the fact that the saints had been so injudicious in informing their enemies that God was going to smite them or this is our land. They were not wise in bragging about the fact that, you know, the Lord was going to give this to them for Zion. So if you're living there and some religious group comes and says, hey, this is our land, we're going to have it back one way or the other, you're not going to feel too good about that.
Oh, there was actually a group of Missourians who 2 days later on June 23rd wrote their response to that. And they quoted from the previous revelation, it was saying that the land of Zion shall be obtained, but by purchase or by blood. And they're like, look, these guys plan to imbue the whole upper Missouri in blood and carnage if we don't give them what they want. And there have been times where the Lord has told them, hey, I'm telling you this, but don't publish it to the world. And what did the people in Missouri do? Oh, they published it to the world. They bragged about how the Lord had promised them the state of Missouri.
Yeah, so we're going to see similar advice from the Lord even in section 105.
Yep. So should we jump on in?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, so this is on June 22nd. It was during that council that you talked about, and Joseph received this revelation. Verily I say unto you who have assembled yourselves together that you may learn my will concerning the redemption of my afflicted people. Behold, I say unto you, were it not for the transgressions of my people, speaking concerning the church or the body and not individuals, they might have been redeemed even now. But behold, they have not learned to be obedient to the things which I require at their hands, but are full of all manner of evil and do not impart of their substance as become saints to the poor and afflicted among them, and are not united according to the union required by the law of the celestial kingdom. And Zion cannot be built up unless it is by the principles of the law of the celestial kingdom. Otherwise, I cannot receive her unto myself.
Verse 3 and 4 and 5 are so important for us to understand, because the Lord is telling us so plainly that if we want Zion, we have to live the law of the celestial kingdom. And the law of the celestial kingdom is to impart of your substance and to be united. And anything other than that here is defined as evil. So if you look in the church today, we talk about the law of the celestial kingdom. And we say, to get to the celestial kingdom, you need to go to the temple and be on the covenant path. And we've redefined the law of consecration as giving, you know, your time, your talents, everything the Lord has blessed you with or will bless you with to the church. But we're not equal. We make no attempt to be equal or united. Our definition of united is follow the prophet and we'll all be united. March in lockstep behind Russell Nelson. And yet the Lord is very clearly saying, you guys want to live in a celestial state? You have to follow these laws. And we're not doing that at all.
No. And actually, our listener and frequent commenter, Paul, actually sent me a link to a news article from the Salt Lake Tribune on December 2nd, which talks about how the LDS Church and the state of Utah entered into an agreement where the state of Utah is able to take credit for welfare services that the LDS Church provides so that the state can reduce the amount of benefits they actually offer to the poor and the afflicted in the state. And so it's gotten to the point where people can't get any help from the state welfare program. And then when they go to the bishop, and they call it bishop roulette, some bishops are very generous. But other bishops are like, I can't give you anything until you become a member of the church and adhere to all these behavioral things that we insist upon. And so they've got people that are pretending to be interested in the Mormon church and getting baptized simply because they need food to feed their family. And that's the only way they can do it.
So this was news to me, and I just Googled it. How has Utah saved $75 million on welfare? By providing next to nothing and taking credit for LDS welfare instead. Holy smokes. Well, I'll have to read this in detail. I won't do it now, but thanks for bringing that to my attention. You know, certainly the Lord wants us to not be idle, but those who really need help, they need us to open our purses wide, yet we're not doing it. The concept of consecration in the LDS Church means nothing compared to how the Lord has defined it in his law.
Yeah, and just back to verse 5, Zion cannot be built up unless it is by the principles of the law of the celestial kingdom, which celestial kingdom requires the saints to impart of their substance to the poor and afflicted. And we don't have any of that. We know we haven't practiced the law of consecration since 1834, and yet we say, well, God's a liar. He actually was able to build up Zion, even though we didn't do all of those things he said had to happen.
Because Zion is big investment accounts through Ensign Peak Advisors. That's Zion, man. We're prospering. But look at verse 6. And my people must needs be chastened until they learn obedience, if it must needs be by the things which they suffer. I mean, the Lord is saying, until we learn to live the law of Zion, we are going to suffer. We are going to be chastened and suffer until collectively we obey the law of the celestial kingdom, consecration.
Here's a thought for you. Doctrine and Covenants, section 88, verse 22. For he who is not able to abide the law of a celestial kingdom cannot abide a celestial glory. Well, that's not true. I just have to be willing to abide the law of the celestial kingdom. I don't have to actually do it.
The problem I have is that our leaders are not talking about this at all. There's no discussion about how in preparation for Zion, we need to live the law of consecration. And you know why? Because of the hypocrisy associated with how they actually run the organization and use the dollars. People would call them on the carpet if they started to switch their tune without actually switching their practice. And do things like be apostles in the truest sense of the word and go without purse or scrip yourself. Don't hang on to that $980 million of stock that Stevenson still holds. Be examples, true examples of what it takes to be a Zion-like people. But we're not being led in that direction. which is why, you know, the condemnation upon the prophets who claim to be prophets in Jeremiah 23 and other places just so applies to the modern Mormon church today.
And then verse 7 is interesting. I speak not concerning those who are appointed to lead my people, who are the first elders of my church. And I think that's so important. There's so many scriptural references to these first elders and what their mission is and what the Lord expects them to go off and do before the second coming. And it's those people who are appointed at this time. They are not all under this condemnation. But I speak concerning my churches abroad, the people abroad. There are many who will say, where is their God? Behold, he will deliver them in the time of trouble. Otherwise, we will not go up unto Zion and will keep our monies. Therefore, in consequence of the transgressions of my people, it is expedient in me that my elders should wait for a little season for the redemption of Zion.
So I take two things out of what you just read. Some of the first elders seem to be under condemnation because it says not all are under condemnation. We don't know who, but there may be a few. And then it seems like these other churches are saying, oh, God will deliver them. We don't need to impart of our substance. We can withhold our support. He'll do it himself. We don't need to be part of that. Those are the churches outside not imparting of their substance. Like John Carrill said, the poor ran into Zion and the rich didn't send their monies. It was a recipe for disaster. Regardless, the consequence here is that the redemption of Zion has been delayed for a little season, which the Lord uses as this amorphous time horizon that we don't know. Sometimes it's a short period of time. Sometimes it's a very long period of time. But look at verse 10. That they themselves may be prepared, that my people may be taught more perfectly and have experience and know more perfectly concerning their duty and the things which I require at their hands. So we're in this little season right now, which is a time of preparation, but what's going on? Are we being prepared for Zion? Are we being taught more perfectly how to live the celestial law? Are we having experience consecrating to understand our duty? No, I don't think so.
You're right. You know, how can we claim to have Zion today when we haven't done any of the things that the Lord has told us need to happen? In fact, we've gotten less prepared and we've been taught falsely. And the experience we have is leading us in the totally opposite direction.
I mean, indeed, we have the curses around our neck at this point, and won't be relieved until the restoration actually happens. You know, the next couple of verses, I think, point to a future fulfillment. There was a present fulfillment there in Kirtland, but verse 11, and this cannot be brought to pass until mine elders are endowed with power from on high. For behold, I have prepared a great endowment and blessing to be poured out upon them, inasmuch as they are faithful and continue in humility before me. Zion is not going to be established until the elders are endowed. And we'll see that some of these elders were endowed in Kirtland. And just to kind of tie the thread together, the Lord actually says in section 110 that there was an endowment that took place at the Kirtland Temple dedication. But he also refers to a future endowment that's going to take place. And, you know, this is my personal opinion, but I actually think that the Kirtland Temple is still going to be used as a place where an endowment will happen for the elders prior to the redemption of Zion. But it's interesting that Lord talks about this endowment as a blessing. If our listeners ever read the second volume of the history of the church in the lead up to the Kirtland Temple time period, the word endowment is used all the time. And it has nothing to do with the endowment that the modern Mormon would think, if you were to use that term. It's always a spiritual endowment and a blessing. It's the second volume that I have tons of sticky notes on because it's just so pregnant with good information that anybody should take the time and read. So continuing on verse 13, therefore it is expedient in me that mine elders should wait for a little season for the redemption of Zion. For behold, I do not require at their hands to fight the battles of Zion. For as I said in a former commandment, even so will I fulfill. I will fight your battles. Behold, the destroyer I have sent forth to destroy and lay waste mine enemies, and not many years hence they shall not be left to pollute mine heritage and to blaspheme my name upon the lands which I have consecrated for the gathering together of my saints. So as we're told here again, Jesus will fight the battles of Zion, but he has to have a sanctified and a consecrated people to be able to do it. That endowment of spiritual power is going to come before that ever happens. And then the Lord will make bare his arm and fight their battles.
The thing that jumps out at me is the last part of verse 15, where he talks about this is going to happen upon the lands which I have consecrated for the gathering of my saints, like India and Australia and Asia.
Well, the whole world, everywhere there's a stake, my friend. What are there, like 3,000 and something stakes? So there must be 3,000 Zions.
And it's not that someone else has consecrated. It's that the Lord has consecrated for the gathering of his saints.
And despite the fact that the Lord is going to fight their battles, verse 16 says, behold, I have commanded my servant Joseph Smith Jr. to say unto the strength of my house, even my warriors, my young men and middle aged, to gather together for the redemption of my people, and throw down the towers of mine enemies, and scatter their watchmen. But the strength of mine house have not hearkened unto my words. But inasmuch as there are those who have hearkened unto my words, I have prepared a blessing and an endowment for them, if they continue faithful. I have heard their prayers, and will accept their offering. And it is expedient in me that they should be brought thus far for a trial of their faith. When you read the journals of the expedition of Zion's camp, there were those who were humble and prayerful, and there were those who caused trouble. I think this really relates to us today, where redemption and salvation is an individual affair right now when we don't have the fullness of the gospel. It's incumbent on every individual to stake their claim. Are they going to be on the Lord's side, or are they going to fight against Zion?
And then it goes on in verse 20, and now verily I say unto you, a commandment I give unto you, that as many as have come up hither that can stay in the region round about, let them stay. And those that cannot stay, who have families in the east, let them tarry for a little season, inasmuch as my servant Joseph shall appoint unto them. For I will counsel him concerning this matter, and all things whatsoever he shall appoint unto them shall be fulfilled. I want to put a little pin in that. We'll get back to that after we finish this section. And let all my people who dwell in the regions round about be very faithful and prayerful and humble before me, and reveal not the things which I have revealed unto them, until it is wisdom in me that they should be revealed. And this gets back to what we talked about earlier. Don't tell the people I've given you this land. Don't tell the people that I'm sending the destroyer to wipe them out if they continue to fight against you. And what do? They brag about it.
Yeah, it just takes one to go off and flap their jaws.
Yeah, and the Lord goes on in 24, talk not of judgments, neither boast of faith nor of mighty works, but carefully gather together as much in one region as can be, consistently with the feelings of the people. And behold, I will give unto you favor and grace in their eyes, that you may rest in peace and safety, while you are saying unto the people, execute judgment and justice for us according to law, and redress us of our wrongs. So that's the plan. Don't go lording it over them that I'm on your side. Just use the laws, try to get your property back. And if you do that, now behold, I say unto you, my friends, in this way you may find favor in the eyes of the people until the army of Israel becomes very great. And I will soften the hearts of the people as I did the heart of Pharaoh from time to time, until my servant Joseph Smith Jr. and my elders whom I have appointed shall have time to gather up the strength of my house and to have sent wise men to fulfill that which I have commanded concerning the purchasing of all the lands in Jackson County that can be purchased, and in the adjoining counties round about. Has that happened yet?
Negative. You know, I look at this section here, 26 through 29, again, as a future prophecy. Everything that got delayed and didn't happen the first time around, if we believe the Lord, they've got to happen the second time around.
And if we follow the word lengths, it takes us right back to section 101. verses 55 and 56. The Lord of the vineyard says unto one of his servants, go and gather the residue of my servants and take all the strength of mine house. But wait, strength of the house? That's what Joseph's supposed to do. My warriors, my young men, and they that are of middle age also, among all my servants who are the strength of my house, and go ye straightway unto the land of my vineyard and redeem my vineyard, for it is mine. I have bought it with money. So again, the Lord's saying, I can't redeem this until you buy it, because I'm only going to redeem what I already own.
Why is the Lord doing it that way? You know, you look at the children of Israel anciently, they were told this is a promised land. They went in by blood and kicked out the Philistines and those who were occupying the land. But here in America, this last time, the Lord's saying, buy up all that you can, have a legal claim, and if that doesn't get recognized, I will fight your battles if people are going to fight against you. But I want you to have a legal claim to this land. And he also wants us to consecrate. He wants to teach us to consecrate. That's my opinion, but I think that's part of it.
Well, that's in the next verses here. Verse 29, it is my will that these lands should be purchased, and after they are purchased, that my saints should possess them according to the laws of consecration, which I have given them. You can't have the redemption of Zion without the laws of consecration. Those go hand in hand. And after these lands are purchased, I will hold the armies of Israel guiltless in taking possession of their own lands, which they have previously purchased with their monies. We don't get to go in there and just kick everyone off of their own land. We can only kick them off of land that we legitimately own. And of throwing down the towers of my enemies that may be upon them and scattering their watchmen. Where have we heard that before?
Yeah, I mean, this makes me believe that there will be apostate groups of one form or another claiming to be the Lord's sitting on the property that those who are willing to consecrate are going to inhabit and purchase. So there's going to be squatters that claim that they're the Lord's. A tower to me is a temple. A watchman is a leader of a group. I mean, we're not talking about the towers of government here. I think we're talking about apostate groups that claim to be the Lord's. And then in 31, but let my army become very great, and let it be sanctified before me, that it may become fair as the sun and clear as the moon, and that her banners may be terrible unto all nations. I mean, that harkens back to Isaiah. That the kingdoms of this world may be constrained to acknowledge that the kingdom of Zion is in very deed the kingdom of our God and is Christ. Therefore, let us become subject unto her laws. And what laws are those? The laws of the celestial kingdom. Let my army become very great. Well, why does the Lord need an army if he's going to fight the battles? That's the question that came to my mind. And I think it's just that he wants a sanctified people. He calls them an army, but he wants a people who will live the celestial law. It's not that by force of arms they are going to conquer or redeem, because the Lord is actually going to do that for them.
I think we need to set aside the military army visions we have and think about onward Christian soldier type of stuff. These are the elders that are going to go out in strength and power to preach the gospel and reestablish the kingdom. It's not guys with AK-47s and AR-15s that are going to kill everyone that opposes us. You know, it's these armies of people on his side doing spiritual warfare, not modern military warfare. Before Zion can be redeemed and before we can get back onto these lands, this army of God needs to get to the point where the kingdoms of this world are going to be constrained to acknowledge that the kingdom of Zion is in very deed, not in word, in very deed, the kingdom of our God and his Christ. And then they willingly want to become subject unto the laws of Zion.
So constrained is an interesting term here. Forced. They're going to be forced to acknowledge one way or another. We can speculate as to how they will be forced to acknowledge that.
I think it's forced by circumstances. When they see Babylon crumbling and Zion rising, I think at some point they're just going to go, okay, everything we thought would protect us is failing, and this one thing that we thought was ridiculous is actually working.
Yeah, that's the only lifeboat that's afloat, right, in a crumbling world. Yep. And then you emphasize the very deed. So what does this mean? It means that Zion is going to be living the celestial law. It's not going to be faking it. It's not going to be redefining it. It is going to be actually living it. Just like the ancient Nephites in 4th Nephi, who were the happiest people on the planet for 200 years or so. Same thing is going to be happening, and the rest of the world is going to see it.
And it gets back to the introductory verses here. The law of the celestial kingdom is to impart of your substance unto the poor, and Zion cannot be built up on anything other than that principle. So when it's in very deed, it's not even, we believe that one day the Lord will have us cash in all of our investments and help the poor. It's, we're currently doing that.
Right. But before that can happen, starting in verse 33, verily I say unto you, it is expedient in me that the first elders of my church should receive their endowment from on high in my house, which I have commanded to be built unto my name in the land of Kirtland. And let those commandments which I have given concerning Zion and her law be executed and fulfilled after her redemption. Well, she hasn't been redeemed. So again, I think this points to a future fulfillment. There has been a day of calling, but the time has come for a day of choosing. Many are called, few are chosen. So now is the time to be chosen. And let those be chosen that are worthy. And it shall be manifest unto my servant by the voice of the Spirit, those that are chosen, and they shall be sanctified. This endowment seems to be a sanctifying experience. And inasmuch as they follow the counsel which they receive, they shall have power after many days to accomplish all things pertaining to Zion. So again, an allusion to the future, after many days.
Inasmuch as they follow the counsel which they receive. Well, that's a huge condition, because we ignore a lot of the counsel that we've already received. So he seemed to be saying, once they finally start actually listening to the stuff I've already told them, then they'll have power to accomplish all the things pertaining to Zion, which explains why it wasn't redeemed 150 years ago.
Like things in the Doctrine and Covenants that were codified during Joseph's lifetime. I mean, that's why the Lord gave the Doctrine and Covenants to the downgraded church. You guys need to learn the doctrine, the lectures on faith. You need to learn of the covenants that I've made via my revelations. And then at some point, once you learn that, you'll be in a situation where you can be redeemed. And yet we ignore so much of that and take it out of our canon. We've transfigured the word of God.
In verse 37 here, inasmuch as they follow the counsel which they receive, they shall have power after many days to accomplish those things. Well, DNC 101, verse 62, his servant went straightway and did all things whatsoever his Lord commanded him. And after many days, all things were fulfilled. Section 101, section 103, and section 105 are all one story that need to be read together.
We never read it because it's too damning to us when you actually believe it. It's too damning in terms of our failures to establish Zion, even today.
I don't want to focus on the activities of the people back then, but I think it's so damning of everything we've said since then to justify why what we're doing is okay now, when everything would indicate no, until we repent and get back to what the Lord has already told us to do, we're even more apostate than those people are, because now we've been warned.
But not only that, we believe that the Lord is actually talking to us and he's changing his mind. It forces us into a state of cognitive dissonance, because you can't reconcile what he's saying here in his actual word, in his actual revelations, with what we hear out of Salt Lake. We're led to believe that the Lord just, oh, well, I changed my mind. plan B. But where does he ever say there's a plan B? He never says there's a plan B.
I think we're on plan D, E, or F right now.
And we need to get back to his original plan, plan A, which is laid out here in his Revelations.
And then closing it up, verse 38, again, I say unto you, sue for peace, not only to the people that have smitten you, but also to all people, and lift up an ensign of peace, and make a proclamation of peace unto the ends of the earth, and make proposals for peace unto those who have smitten you, according to the voice of the Spirit which is in you, and all things shall work together for your good. You know, we had section 98 that talked about when your enemies come against you, sue for peace, make a proposal for peace. And the Lord's continuing to say it here. Find a peaceful solution. And that resolution that we read before we started this, I think, was one of those attempts. You pick six people, we'll pick six people, and let's negotiate. Let's figure out a solution to this. It doesn't have to come down to violence. And we need to keep doing that. And unfortunately, they did not do that in 1838.
No. So I doubt that many of our listeners are going to be familiar with what we're going to read next. But it's from The History of the Church, Volume 2, on pages 112 and 113. This happened the day after this revelation that we just went through, 105. And it was a council of high priests, including Joseph, that met to select elders to travel to Kirtland, Ohio, to receive an endowment of power in accordance with the instruction given in what we just read in 105. So Joseph is then identifying those who are chosen. And we remember back in June of 1831, 23 high priests were called. Then we get an identification of 15 of the first elders here who are called and chosen to then receive their endowment. As I look through this list, it's pretty interesting to me because the Lord can identify for us who some of these first elders are. I don't think this is an exclusive list. There are some obvious names that I think I would add, like Oliver Cowdery, like Sidney Rigdon, like Frederick G. Williams. But did you have any impressions of this list, Chris, as you looked over it?
The one thing that really just jumps out at me is the variety of outcomes for these people. Because you have some that become, quote, apostates. You have others that follow Brigham to Utah and become avowed polygamists. So while they're chosen at this time, once darkness starts descending upon the church, they don't all take a unified path. They all go different ways.
The one thing that I really noticed, though, is that there are only two names here of individuals who are called as 12 apostles, and Brigham is not one of them. Brigham Young is not on this list. You have Thomas Marsh, who was the president of the Quorum of the 12, and you have Parley P. Pratt. And yet we know that Brigham was on this Zion's camp. So he was there. But he is not being chosen as one of the first elders by the Lord. So if we look down this list, we've got Edward Partridge, the bishop. You have W.W. Phelps, who's the printer. You have Isaac Morley, who owned the farm in Kirtland. You have John Carrill, who was a counselor to the bishop. You have John Whitmer. You have David Whitmer, Sidney Gilbert, Peter Whitmer, Simeon Carter, Newell Knight, Thomas B. Marsh, Lyman White, Parley P. Pratt, Christian Whitmer, and Solomon Hancock. But you don't have Heber C. Kimball. You don't have Wilford Woodruff. You don't have Brigham Young. You don't have some of these prominent 12 apostles who actually went west. And I think Parley P. Pratt was probably the only one on this list that I'm aware of that followed Brigham and ended up in Utah.
William Phelps.
You're right about that. So those two. And yet, if you read what Joseph records here, the council of high priests met, according to Revelation, in order to choose some of the first elders to receive their endowments, being appointed by the voice of the Spirit through Brother Joseph Smith, president of the Church of Christ. Interesting that whoever was the scribe didn't remember that they had just become the Church of the Latter-day Saints a month previous to this.
He may not have been at the meeting in Kirtland.
Maybe not. Each of these individuals is called by name, and I don't want to read all of them, but for Edward Partridge, it says Edward Partridge is called and chosen and is to go to Kirtland to receive his endowment with power from on high and also stand in his office as bishop to purchase lands in the land of Missouri. W.W. Phelps is the second one. He is called and chosen, and it is appointed unto him to receive his endowment with power from on high and help carry on the printing establishment in Kirtland till Zion is redeemed. So there's a connection of being chosen, and some of their individual stewardships are actually identified. Parley P. Pratt, for example, is called and chosen, and it is appointed unto him to receive his endowment in Kirtland with power from on high and assist in gathering up the strength of the Lord's house and proclaim the gospel. So here we have it, you know, straight via the Spirit through Joseph, calling these men to go to Kirtland and receive their endowment with power. No secret handshakes necessary.
Yeah, definitely a different endowment than what came later. The other thing I just want to hit on is I told you to put a pin in something back in verse 20, where the Lord talks about some of you are going to stay in the region round about and others you need to head back, and Joseph's going to figure that stuff out. And so then we get this meeting on June 23rd where they say, all right, these 15 elders, they all need to head back to Kirtland to prepare for their endowment. But some of them were leaders in independence. And so on July 7th, there was a high council meeting held. And it says that Joseph Smith laid the case of William W. Phelps before the council to have their decision whether he should take his family to Kirtland and when it shall be wisdom for him to go, as it has been deemed necessary for him to go and assist in the printing establishment. And so then the meeting minutes reflect that they nominated four of the counselors to speak on the subject, two on each side. And you had Simeon Carter and William McClellan on the side of the plaintiff, and Parley Pratt and Calvin Beebe on behalf of the church. And after they had said on the subject all they had to say, the president decided that it is the duty of Brother W.W. Phelps to go to Kirtland to assist in the printing business, and that his family remain in this region of country, and that he have an honorable discharge of his station in this place for a season. And then they also talk about David Whitmer, and that he should go to Kirtland because he's one of the three witnesses, and he should assist in promoting the cause of Christ. And so then Levi Jackman and Christian Whitmer argue in behalf of the plaintiff, and Solomon Hancock and Newell Knight for the church. And after their pleadings, it was decided that David Whitmer should go to the East and assist in the great work of the gathering and be his own judge as to leaving his family or taking them with him.
I'm trying to put this within the context of what I know about plaintiffs and defendants. It sounds like there were two sides of the question, stay or go. But which one was the plaintiff, you know, what was the church advocating versus what the plaintiff was advocating?
I also just thought it was fascinating where Joseph's saying, well, I'd like W.W. Phelps to come on up to Kirtland right away, but I need your permission.
Right. When you put it that way, in today's world, it would just be an assignment. We are calling you to go do this, accept or not, because that's the Lord's will. The Lord is open for discussion and debate. You know, he doesn't just shut down the debate and say, hey, you're going. If you reject it, you'll be damned.
Yeah, I see this as a beautiful example of common consent. Joseph says, this is what I'd like to have happen. I'd like to pull some of your leadership out and move them back to Kirtland. But you guys have to decide that because you're the ones that are going to be impacted. Today, that would never happen. They would swoop in, pull any leadership out of any ward or stake they want and move them anywhere they want, and it's a done deal. No one can go in and say, well, let's talk about this. You can't.
Even think about how they selected stake presidents or bishops. I hate to even look. There's the indoctrination in my head still about bishops overseeing wards. Bishops do not oversee wards. It's the high council of a stake and the elders that oversee that, not a bishop of a particular ward. So that just tells you of my level of indoctrination. But the local populace, the members, would actually vote on who their leaders were. They would vote on who was going to be the stake president. It wasn't some apostle that showed up and said, he's going to be your stake president. They even voted separately on counselors. So it wasn't the stake president who chose his counselors. It was the body of the saints who chose the counselors. I'll try to find that in today's LDS world.
Yep.
All right. Well, should we get to a very important piece of history that came a couple of months later on August 16th, where Joseph identifies the time frame for the redemption of Zion? He writes to Lyman White, Edward Partridge, John Carrill, Isaac Morley, and others of the High Council of Zion from Kirtland. So Joseph had returned to Kirtland, and he writes this letter to these leaders in Zion. Use every effort to prevail on the churches to gather to those regions and situate themselves to be in readiness to move into Jackson County in 2 years from the 11th of September next, which is the appointed time for the redemption of Zion. So that's September 11th, 1836. Verily I say unto you, if the church with one united effort perform their duties, if they do this, the work shall be complete. It's interesting to me that he calls it the appointed time for the redemption of Zion. I've got to believe that that's appointed by the Lord. And he urges them on then with words of, now, my beloved brethren, you will learn by this, we have a great work to do and but little time to do it in. And if we do not exert ourselves to the utmost in gathering up the strength of the Lord's house, that this thing may be accomplished, behold, there remaineth a scourge for the church, even that they shall be driven from city to city, and but few shall remain to receive an inheritance. If those things are not kept, there remaineth a scourge also. Therefore be wise this once, O ye children of Zion, and give heed to my counsel, saith the Lord. And yet we know that nothing happened on that date.
To focus in on that appointed time, if we go back to section 105 that we just read, verse 27, I will soften the hearts of the people as I did of Pharaoh from time to time until my servant Joseph Smith and my elders who I appointed shall have time to gather up the strength of my house and to have sent wise men to fulfill that which I have commanded concerning the purchasing of all the lands in Jackson County. The appointed time seems to have been this 2-year window they have to go off and purchase the lands and get prepared spiritually for the redemption of Zion, and it doesn't happen.
And when you realize that they got downgraded at the Kirtland Temple just a few months, 6 months essentially, before the September 11th date of 1836, then it all kind of makes sense. The redemption of Zion got delayed, and all hell broke loose after that. So, Chris, when you look at the history and you look at these scriptures and you put them within context, it paints a whole new picture that we've been talking about, obviously, in these episodes over the last 3 years, of how our church has been downgraded. Very few people want to accept that. It's a very hard thing for so many members of the church to get their arms around. It's a challenge to anybody's faith. You and I see people who just, you know, either go atheist or throw out the Jesus baby with the bathwater. And yet the Lord is saying we need to prepare ourselves to be able to live in a Zion-like society. You know, that's not an easy thing to do. As we go about our business, as we're trying to make a living. But I think even though we can't live in a Zion-like consecrated celestial law society, we can try to prepare our hearts to do that. And in some small way, I'm hoping that I will be worthy to do that, that I can be willing to consecrate. We talk about it all the time. But until that actually happens, are we going to know? I think it's going to take a lot of faith to actually live in Zion and to consecrate. And I think it's going to be a wonderful experience once you actually make that leap and trust in God as opposed to trust in man. Because that's really what it takes, is trusting God and looking to him instead of at your neighbor. We'll see. I look forward to it.
It does take me back to those opening verses in section 105. In consequence of the transgression of his people, he's given us this little season for us to be prepared and to be taught more perfectly and to have experience and to learn our duties and the things that the Lord requires our hands. And I think that's what those of us who are sitting on this side of the fence and realizing, okay, what I'm hearing out of Salt Lake isn't going to get me closer to Zion, but I can't go and build Zion myself. So what can I do? I can spend this time truly learning what God wants me to do based on the scriptures versus based on the teachings of men.
Yeah, I think that's what we have to do today. And also seek to cast off the false traditions of our fathers. To do that, though, you first have to identify those false traditions. The only way I know is it really harkens back to what you call your own blog, right? Measuring doctrine. It's measuring every man's doctrine against the word of the Lord. That's how you're able to detect truth from falsehood. Where you find discrepancies, that's where you need to poke deeper and apply the law of witnesses. That's what we can do today.
All right. Well, that's what we're going to do today. What are we going to do next week?
Next week, we are going to stay in the history for a little bit. We're going to talk about a committee that was supposed to arrange the doctrine of the church. We're going to talk about a school of the elders. We're going to be in section 106. And also a covenant of tithing that was entered into by Joseph and Oliver. A little more history on a condemnation revelation that happened in 1834. And then we get the patriarch introduced into the church. So there's a lot going on here behind the scenes. We'll try to bring some clarity to what's happening. Next week's going to be a little more history along with section 106. So those who want to pre-read the history, go to volume 2, start in on page 165 and read to 177 at the very minimum. And I think that'll give you a really good primer on what we're going to be talking about.
Great. Well, thank you, sir. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a great week, and we'll catch you next time on the Iron Rod Podcast.